From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
For all of you history buffs, we have a great lineup on the program today, featuring Warren Woods Tower High School social studies teacher Jason Doherty, from the Michigan Flight Museum, Carl Schmidt, from the Michigan Science Center, Christian Greer, and I'll be rounding out the program talking a little bit about Livernoy Avenue, a street that is part of my family's heritage. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Jason Doherty, a social studies teacher from Warren Woods Tower High School in Warren, Michigan. Welcome to the program, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. So, in this day and age, with all the sources of information, social media, television, you name it, it seems like an opportune time for a social studies teacher to teach history, just given the available information and, unfortunately, the misinformation. And in your line of thinking, why is teaching history so relevant, especially in this day and age?
Well, teaching social studies and history is always relevant. Sometimes we're kind of relegated to the back burner of the core subjects, but now more than ever, you know, people need to know how to think analytically. And that's really been the a major focus of ours in the past couple of years. Obviously, with history, we're learning about major events and facts and dates, and that's always been an important part of the study of history. But getting students to think analytically, to make connections, to think critically, and is a lifelong skill, no matter what students' future holds. I mean, our grandparents learned history really where they were memorizing facts and dates. And facts and dates will always be an important part of the subject for sure. But now we are focused more on trying to get students to connect these facts and dates to the present, and also to make arguments using these facts and dates, and analyzing and using evidence to analyze.
You know, for many years in education, we've always talked about how important it is to teach critical thinking. It's sort of been a buzzword of ours for at least the last 20 years in my experience. And when you think about the availability of misinformation, especially as we walk toward that threshold of artificial intelligence, when you think about the amount of misinformation that's out there, I couldn't think of a more important time to teach children how to think analytically. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, AI is going to be, I mean, it's here with us, and I see it in a lot of the work that students use, and I know it can be a great tool that we can use to get more information and for it to nudge us along, maybe with our analysis. But for me, it's so important to teach students how to find information on their own, how to find information that's relevant and real. We do a lot of that in class. And also to make sure students can back up the assertions that they make with evidence and analysis. And that's also a big push of our classes here at Warren Woods Tower. Not only do students have to find evidence to support their kind of perspective or their argument in history, but they need to explain where that evidence comes from. They need to cite it so they know that it's maybe real or relevant. And then they need to make arguments about it to prove their assertions.
Mm-hmm. You know, I often wonder, educators' reaction to artificial intelligence, I wonder how alike or different their reaction is to artificial intelligence from the time when educators were faced with students beginning to use calculators. For our School Talks listeners, if you don't know this, we put a man on the moon using a slide rule, and then all of a sudden technology creates calculators. I wonder if the reaction is similar in terms of the loss of critical thinking and, at least back in the day, how to carry the one. But nonetheless, let me change course here. I wanted to get your opinion on something. I was recently having a conversation with a friend of mine, and given AI's ability to create misinformation or videos. You see these on TikTok where they have an athlete at a press conference and the athlete is saying all kinds of crazy things that they're really not saying, but through AI they replicate their voice and so on. And my friend and I were talking about the idea of sometimes you'll see a commercial on TV where someone's promoting a drug or a medicine, and at the bottom of the screen it says, this celebrity is a paid spokesperson, right? And I wonder how important it would be for our culture long term to require that videos, when they're made with AI, have some type of, you know, symbol on it that lets the people watching it know. And I'm not naive to think that the, you know, the billions of videos that are available would be quite challenging. But because when you tie this to the experience we just had going through the recent election season, I wonder, in your perspective as a social studies teacher, how did the election cycle provide you an opportunity for students to make connections to history and their place in it?
Well, I think that's a great point and a great question. And I think the interesting thing there is, you know, the cliche about history is always we don't want to repeat mistakes in the past. But the truth in that cliche is there's always something in the past that is similar enough to what's happening where at least can point to a possibility of what's going on now. And so if you want to talk about making sure that commercials are showing whether or not they're using AI, well, that comes down to regulation. We've had several periods in history where the government was really anti-regulatory, and we can see exactly what happened because of that. We can see now with the current political atmosphere, we seem to have an incumbent, again, president, again, Grover Cleveland, two non-consecutive terms, that maybe is pointing us towards maybe a period of isolationism again, or maybe of populism, or pro-tariff. There are points in time in history that we teach about where those things happen. Now, of course, it won't ever turn out to be exactly the same. This is a modern era, but at least there are some signifiers of what this may be. And it's interesting. We listen to current events in class, and I really try to get the students to point to things we've learned about in class and make some kind of comparison to them.
Yeah. We're currently with Jason Doherty, social studies teacher from Warren Woods Tower High School. So, Jason, although teenagers do not have any power to vote, per se, in an election, how do you as a teacher instill in them that they still have power? Because they really do. What are your thoughts on that?
There are so many times in American history where people with very little power, people who have been oppressed, have stood up and changed this country. I mean, if you just look at the civil rights era of the 1940s through the 1970s, African Americans, especially in the South, were oppressed to the point where they had no political voice. And the danger of speaking up meant quite possibly murder. That population of people made this country more democratic for everybody in this country. I mean, this country is more of a democracy because of the civil rights movement than before. And so I try to use instances like that to inspire them to realize that even though they cannot technically vote, or they can't vote, that they still have power with their actions.
Mm-hmm. You know, I recently had a conversation with my daughter. We were talking about history and events and things, and we came to a point where I reminded her that people today are creating history every day in their lives, and you might not connect it that way when you look back at these big movements like the Civil Rights era or you pick the historical event. And I think teenagers have an opportunity to recognize that every day they lead their lives, they have an opportunity to create history. How big or how small really depends on their willingness to pursue it. So in your instruction, how do you help students see that sort of connection between sociological and the human side of history?
Well, so much of history is like sociology in the fact that we're studying human actions and their consequences. And so, you know, student actions and inaction today can impact their future, whether that is the micro, the me, or the macro society. I teach a leadership class where we really get into that a lot, where the students really, they create committees, and their job is to create change throughout the school. And a lot of them are surprised about how much they can accomplish, just a group of like 4, 5, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds.
And Jason Doherty, social studies teacher with Warren Woods Tower High School. You've given our School Talks listeners a lot to think about. I appreciate your time, and keep up the good work there in Warren Woods.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Carl Schmidt from the Michigan Flight Museum. This is 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Once again, at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Carl Schmidt from the Michigan Flight Museum and Air Adventures. Welcome to the program, Carl.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So from time to time on the program, we talk about places where children can go for field trips. There's lots of things around town, whether it's the Detroit Zoo, the Belle Isle Nature Center. There's lots of opportunities for children to go on field trips. And I distinctly remember when my children were little, we went there to the museum and saw some really incredible history. So tell us a little bit about the museum and what can someone expect when they visit?
Yes, thank you. We, at the Michigan Flight Museum, we have a large array of historic aircraft, and we are dedicated to preserving history, exploring aviation as a science, and specifically the Willow Run Bomber Plant is a big part of our history. That's why the airport is there, was built. It's still there today. And we take great pride in talking about the history of the museum and also the relationship to the community and what happened back during World War II.
So in your estimation of the aircraft that is in the museum, what would you consider are one or two of the big features, two of the more popular aircraft?
One of our aircraft is a F-4 Phantom, and it is a fighter bomber that was used extensively during the Vietnam War. So in other words, it's a combat veteran. That is one of the first ones that greet you when you walk in the door. We also have just recently acquired a F-18 Hornet, which was used by the Blue Angels as recently as 4 years ago at some of their air shows around the world.
And given this impressive array of aircraft, how does the museum acquire these planes and the other artifacts that are in the museum?
The majority of our aircraft are on permanent loan from the different military services. For instance, the Hornet I just mentioned is on permanent loan from the Navy. We also have a couple of aircraft from the Marine Corps, and the Phantom is has been there for a number of years. We do have our own couple of aircraft, and then smaller items such as artifacts, photographs, posters, things like that are often donated by family members from military veterans.
You know, if I recall correctly, the museum is set up in a way that it sort of tells a story when you're there. Is that correct?
That is correct. As one of the docents, what we like to say is when people come in, we are able to give them a tour, but we're also able to we're happy to let them kind of do a self-guided tour. And if you come in and go clockwise through the museum, it's pretty much set up chronologically through aviation history.
Yeah, and as a docent yourself, is there any opportunity for visitors or whatnot to actually experience something related to flying or related fields?
Absolutely. We have a number of experiences that are available. One of them actually kind of recreates what Rosie the Riveters did back during the war. So we have what we call a riveting experience, a little bit of a pun there. We also offer a number of flight simulators that can really give the visitor a sense of what it would be like to not just fly an aircraft, but some of our flight simulators also give you an idea of what it would be like to take off from an aircraft carrier and also land.
Fantastic. We're currently joined by Carl Schmidt from the Michigan Flight Museum and Air Adventure. So for our School Talks listeners, what kinds of field trips or experiences do you offer school-age children? Walk us through a typical field trip from, say, an elementary school.
We're very happy to have guests of all ages, but we do try to focus on a learning experience if a school were to come in, and we do that. But we would typically go and kind of walk them through the museum floor. As an example, we are currently partnered with the Ann Arbor Hands-On Museum, and we bring in bringing thousands of sixth graders from the Detroit Public Schools, and we've been doing that for a number of years. That experience, they come in to a classroom setting. Some of the people from the facilitators, the staff from Hands-On Museum, will spend about an hour with them going through the four forces of flight, and then after they are done with that, we'll bring them out onto the floor and give them some hands-on experience looking at, touching, being around real aircraft.
So the partnership with the Ann Arbor Hands-On Museum, are there things at that museum that are aircraft related, or is this just a partnership to work with different groups of students?
It's mostly a partnership to get the kids into a spot or space where they can see airplanes up close and personal. The Ann Arbor Museum itself, I believe they have a few exhibits, but ours is a little bit more extensive, and we are dedicated to that specifically.
Yeah, so yours is substantially more focused, obviously, on aircraft and things like that.
Absolutely.
So I understand that one can actually book a flight on some aircraft, and what kind of planes, and more importantly, where do I sign up? Because I love to fly.
It is a wonderful experience. We, the Air Adventures part of our organization, we do own four flyable aircraft. One of them, as a good example, is over an 80-year-old B-25 Mitchell bomber that was used during World War II. And on our website, you'll be able to find our flight schedule that's coming up. Typically, flight season runs from May into October, and some of those flights take off from our own hangar at Willow Run Airport. Other ones, we do take our planes around the country. We recently had a tour where we went out to Tulsa, Kansas City, and some stops in between, so we'd like to show off our aircraft. We're very proud of them, and we can book flights for any of those things. We also have a helicopter that was used during the Vietnam War, so we are able to offer lots of different experiences.
And all of these flights, they originate out of the Willow Run Airport?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, fantastic. And this might be obvious, but this isn't something you can book on Expedia, right?
That is correct. No. We will we'll be happy to see people come on to the website, which is miflightmuseum.org. And on there right now, we don't have any schedule up yet. Again, the season's not ready to go yet. But being one of the crew members, as I am, on the B-25, we'll be happy to put that up coming up in the spring, and then we'll let you know when we come into town. The engines on our airplanes are pretty loud, and they announce our arrival pretty well.
So how many people can you fit on a B-25?
B-25, normally we will take five paying customers or passengers, and then we also, in that, we'll have a crew of four people.
Wow. So for interested listeners, for our School Talks community, when is the museum open, and how can they get more information?
Our museum's open Tuesday through Sunday. We're open from 10 to 4, and then on Sundays we're open 11 to 4. Our website pretty much has all of that information on it, and also would be a way to find, if you wanted to book a tour, come in and also check out the options for our flight schedule.
Fantastic. One of my favorite places are museums, and this certainly is one of them. Carl Schmidt from the Michigan Flight Museum and Air Adventures, I want to thank you for joining us on the program today with a nice window into our history.
Thank you very much.
After a word from our sponsors, we'll be going way back in history, talking with Christian Greer from the Michigan Science Center and all things dinosaurs. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernois.
Joining us now in the program is Christian Greer from the Michigan Science Center. Welcome to the program, Christian.
It's good to be on the program.
I appreciate your time. I think the best place to start is, what does it mean when we say MISCI as an acronym or an abbreviation of Michigan Science Center? What is it all about?
Yeah, MISCI is more of a nickname for us. Our full name is Michigan Science Center, and science is our middle name. So, but some people call us MISCI, and we are okay with that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a quick way of saying hello in science.
You know, as I was thinking, when my children were little, we had gone there. I can't even tell you how many times, but from what I've read now, it has changed substantially.
Yes.
One of the things I'm curious about for our School Talks listeners is, how do you balance the educational mission of the center compared with it just being a fun place for kids, like on a field trip?
Yeah, I think a lot of people ask that question. And for us, it's we try to make it one and the same. We think learning is fun. So how can you allow people to learn in new and different ways and give them a chance to explore new things in ways that are engaging, exciting, maybe transformational. So we think that's a lot of fun, and we try to do it in a cool way in partnership with teachers and schools and also with families. You know, a parent is, or a caregiver is really a kid's first teacher. And we want to equip them with the ability to teach kids science, technology, engineering, and math, and do it in a fun way. We choose to do our work in informal science education, so we don't really have a curriculum, so to speak. We don't focus so much on the content of science, technology, engineering, and math, although it's, of course, the subject of what we do. We're more on the approach. So it's about exploration, it's about discovery, it's about curiosity.
Mm-hmm. You know, to focus on one word you said, the transformational piece, when I think about teachers who are under pressure every day to cover things,
yes,
you know, the curriculum,
the scope,
et cetera, exactly. And I think about a place like yours, how often a student comes to the center and has that catalyzing moment that this is what I want to be, mm-hmm, and it actually happens that way. In my career, I've met more students who have had that catalyzing moment, either on a field trip or the result of a really good relationship with a teacher.
Yes.
There's somewhere in that path, there's this moment where, and it's nice to hear that the center is focused that way.
Yes, I think you're making an incredible insight, and it really, I think, supports the idea of place-based learning. Can you learn things in a location that allows you to activate certain parts of your mind, your consciousness, how you take in information, how you process it? So we want to be that place. We want to be a place that stimulates all the different faculties of these kids and really gives them a chance to do things that are also embodied. Our latest exhibit, which is called Gamers Village, it is an adaptation of Level Up, which was an exhibit all about the science of games, uses embodied learning. And this is a place where kids get a chance to move around as they're learning. So some of the best teachers are ones that get kids up moving around. It almost feels more like recess than it is sitting in a chair and taking it in.
Yeah, you mentioned the gamers one. It's no secret kids are into gaming.
They're into games, right? You can't lose.
I know some universities that have degrees in gaming, programming,
that's right,
and
yes,
so on.
Yes.
So in the spirit of that, what is your favorite exhibit at the center?
Well, you know, probably the one that's not broken. We're an older science center, and we have made a lot of changes to keep things up. But some of our exhibits are older, and they take a lot of maintenance. So we pride ourselves in trying to keep things as up-to-date as possible. But I think that one thing that I like the most is probably the planetarium. You know, speaking of place-based learning, imagine not just being on Earth, but going out to an asteroid and riding along, or traveling to Saturn and flying through the rings, or maybe you're in a nebula with diffuse gas and you're just trying to understand what's out there. Like, why not? We even named one of our shows What's Out There. And to the point that you're making about that catalyzing moment, sometimes we just cheat and just put ourselves in the mind of a young kid, and what would they want to see? And we get a chance to do that a little bit because we don't have a set curriculum, although we align to standards like national science standards and things like that. We're more focused on ways of knowing and ways of learning, and that gives us the ability to really augment what's going on in the classroom.
You know, we're with Christian Greer currently from Michigan Science Center. Following up on that, one thing on the catalyzing moment thought, when you think about all of the standards and expectations that follow for a student, if they have that moment, the rest of that stuff takes care of itself.
Doesn't it?
Because of their interest in it.
Oh, yeah.
It's all about discovery.
Yeah, so. You're just open to learning that. And I think, you know, a lot of times when we think about teaching, the content is a very important thing because we're a civilization. We want to make sure that things that have been discovered get passed on. That's an important thing. A lot of the technology we have, you know, if someone had to learn how to build this soundboard from scratch, you know, it would be hard for the average person, even if they have an electrical engineering degree, to do that. Mm-hmm. In part because we learn, I guess Newton said it best, you know, he sees so far because he stood on the shoulders of giants. This is an important thing. The giants are our ancestors in learning. And I believe that education really is supposed to expand one's learning potential. Mm-hmm. So if you say learning potential, you're not talking about all the things you need to learn right now or where it is. And in today's society, in the 21st century, it's all available on Google or ChatGPT. So, but what is your potential to use those tools to do more things, greater things, to challenge yourself and really push the boundaries of human understanding? I think that's what it's all about.
My favorite example in that line of thinking is long before they started doing the math to go to the moon in the 50s and the
60s. Yeah, that was done in 400 years ago.
It, not only that, someone had to think about, all right, how do we get there?
Yes.
Long before a slide rule or anything told you what to do.
Oh, absolutely. Galileo really focused on that. He had this idea of shooting a cannon as hard or as fast as it could go. Would it go out where its arc and its curve would match the curvature of the Earth? Mm-hmm. And that's what an orbit is. You know, we think about going out in orbit, you're just out in space. But really, it's like throwing a baseball, but throwing it so fast and so hard that the curve, that parabolic path, actually matches the Earth. And if you can do that, then it'll just go around perpetually. And that's what he imagined, even though 400 some odd years later, we didn't have the technology. You hit the nail on the head. This is what I think is important. What's being discovered right now and what we know about math, we won't even see the results of this stuff for many, many years.
Sure. You know, I have to ask, the Tyrannosaurus exhibit and the Meet the Family thing, tell us a little bit about that, because for me, this is exciting stuff.
Yeah, so our latest traveling exhibit is called Tyrannosaurus Meet the Family. It's all about the super family of Tyrannosaurs. And what I think is really interesting about this exhibition, not only does it have casts of these bones, but it features a Tyrannosaur that was found in Saskatchewan by the Australian Museum, a paleontology group that went out searching for dinosaurs, which is a lot of fun. If no one, your listeners, have never had a chance to do that, it's hot. You got to drink a lot of water. You're digging up stuff. You don't really know what you're looking at. And I had a chance to do that with Dr. Paul Serino from the University of Chicago. He's also a National Geographic explorer. I worked for him for a short period of time while I was in Chicago working for an organization called Project Exploration. I found the idea of searching for dinosaurs fascinating. We discovered and uncovered different dinosaurs while we were out there. It was an amazing thing. And one thing that I think is so exciting about this exhibition is it gets you up close and personal with them. Many kids have read about dinosaurs. They have dinosaur plushies. They have dinosaur stickies. They watch TV, filmed, animated series about dinosaurs, but they've never actually seen all the bones. And in Scotty, one of the largest, most complete dinosaurs that we have, it is a T-Rex. It has probably 380 bones, maybe, and it's just a beautiful specimen. And so it's hard to believe that these things actually existed on Earth. It would be scary to be living beside them, which would be crazy, but somehow or another, little kids aren't afraid of them. I don't get it. There was a little girl that walked right up to our van. We do outreach out to almost 85% of the counties in Michigan, and we wrapped it beautifully with a T-Rex on the side of it, and this little girl just walked right up to it and wanted to pet it. How does that happen? You know, I'd be running so far away. So I think it's interesting how, you know, little kids really appreciate animals and animal forms, and they love the idea of what animals can do, and they want to do that. And like you talk about going to the moon, we want to fly. We're an impatient species. We use technology to help get us there.
You know, Christian Greer, you're an enthusiasm for the center. I can't think of a better place for a school to bring children on a field trip,
yes.
Especially when you have exhibits like the Tyrannosaur, just given the scale of it, right?
Oh,
it's
yeah,
one thing
absolutely.
To have a little rubber dinosaur that
that's right.
fit in the palm of
we
your
have
hand.
Those in the store, okay. And they're available for purchase. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, so yeah. What a wonderful experience at the Michigan Science Center. Christian Greer, I thank you for your time this morning. Keep up the good work there at
thank
the
you.
Michigan Science Center.
Thanks it's
so
wonderful
much.
To be on your show. Come see us. Bring your kids.
We'll be coming soon.
Yep.
Thanks.
All right.
After a word from our sponsors, we'll take a little drive down Livernois Avenue. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
School Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Point Moran Real Point, Collins & Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernois.
Teaching history affords students the opportunity to learn about their heritage, the culture, and the customs that make up who they are. History helps us preserve the stories and traditions and values that define many cultures and societies and so on. By passing down this historical knowledge, societies and families ensure that the future generations retain a sense of their heritage and their cultural identity. And this gives me an opportunity to share with you something that happened to me as a very young child. When I was a young kid, my last name, Livernois, I was told somewhat quite regularly that we're somehow connected to a family that had a farm down on the Detroit River, the old, what they call ribbon farms, and all the different farm families that came and started farms in Detroit, many of them eventually had street names named after them. I learned long ago that my ancestors actually came to Detroit with Antoine Lamothe Cadillac and founded the city in 1701. In fact, if you go to Hart Plaza, and when you're in Hart Plaza looking across the river at Canada, on the left-hand side of Hart Plaza, there is a statue of Cadillac, and right near that statue is a very large plaque that was funded and put up by the French-Canadian Heritage Society of Michigan in 2001. And the plaque is a list of all the families who came with Cadillac, and it's known as the Cadillac Convoy. And on that plaque is my family name. And from that point in 1701, through multiple generations, the farms were built, and eventually, when things picked up or population increased in the city and they started to put roads in, they subsequently named them after the families who owned all of the ribbon farms along the river. And Livernois Avenue was first constructed at the edge of the Detroit River, right near the historic Fort Wayne, which was in fact a Civil War fortress constructed by the U.S. Army, ironically to protect against enemy vessels on the river or invasions from Canada back in that time. And through the years, Livernois Street became Livernois Avenue and eventually extended all the way through Detroit in Wayne County, across 8 Mile Road into Oakland County, where it now passes through Ferndale, Clawson, Royal Oak, Troy, and Rochester Hills, where up in this part of the county, it's known as Livernois Road. And as Detroit's population continued to grow, so did the boundaries of the cities. One of the most intriguing things I discovered is at the turn of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, Henry Ford's assembly line and manufacture of the Model T, which as we know put America on wheels, really had an impact on the population. In fact, when Ford announced that he would double the workers' hourly wage to $5 a day, it attracted thousands of people from across the country. And with that came this incredible boom of traffic congestion on Woodward. And because it became so impassable, the decision to expand Livernois across 8 Mile Road was done to help relieve that congestion. And over the years, Livernois Avenue has been widened, and there's a rich history to the kinds of things that happened, one of which I found very intriguing. In 1925, University of Detroit President Reverend John McNichols proposed to the city council that Livernois Avenue be renamed Varsity Boulevard due to the university's expansion and commitment to building more structures and things on the avenue. Unfortunately, Reverend McNichols' request was denied, with the primary defense of keeping the name Livernois out of respect to the family being part of the original French settlement dating back to the founding of the city. Several years later, the issue resurfaced again, and it was denied again, but Reverend McNichols fell ill somewhere around 1932, and out of respect to him, they renamed 6 Mile Road to McNichols. And if you're familiar with that part of town, University of Detroit is at McNichols and Livernois, which is where that history came from. Another really intriguing fact about Livernois Avenue is in 1933, Chris Baker founded Baker's Keyboard Lounge on Livernois Avenue, just south of 8 Mile Road. And Baker's became, and still is, one of America's most iconic jazz venues, hosting people like Ella Fitzgerald, Count Basie, and some of the world's most talented musicians. In fact, a recent guest on our program, School Talks, was Ralph Armstrong, who regularly plays today at Baker's Keyboard Lounge. But on the Avenue of Fashion, which many people know Livernois to be in that part of town, Baker's still operates today, enjoying the claim of being the oldest jazz club in the world. And finally, one thing that I found really fascinating in my research about Livernois is at one point, America was the automobile capital of the world. At its peak, Livernois Avenue was home to a staggering 400 to 600 used car lots in about a 9 mile stretch from Dix Highway near the Detroit River all the way to 8 Mile Road. And when you think about it, when at that time a greater portion of cars in the world were made in Detroit, so too do you end up with a pretty big supply of used cars. And although the car lots back in those days maybe only had 10 or 12 cars for sale, just imagine Livernois Avenue with between 400 and 600 used car lots. It's really tough to even wrap your head around. One last thing, it is well known that the 1960s was the birth of the Motown sound, putting Detroit on the musical map around the world. And although Motown Records is located on West Grand Boulevard, it's not far from Livernois Avenue, where one of Motown's greatest stars, Marvin Gaye, spent quite a bit of his time. In fact, Marvin Gaye lived in a house just off 7 Mile in Livernois, and it is part of Motown legend that he wrote the song What's Going On at this home right near Livernois Avenue. So in all, I consider myself really fortunate to have this rich connection to the history of Detroit through my family name, and it really exemplifies the power that history can afford students when they're learning about things from the past. And on that note, if you haven't been down Livernois Avenue in a while, I encourage you to take a drive down there because the Avenue of Fashion is alive and well. And don't forget to stop at Baker's Keyboard Lounge. I'd like to thank all of our guests for taking time out of their busy schedules. Jason Doherty from Warren Woods Tower High School, Carl Schmidt from the Michigan Flight Museum, and Christian Greer from the Michigan Science Center. That's it for now, but remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.